Okay, good morning everybody. This is Bio241. It's February 4th, Tuesday. We're going to look at a couple administrative things today, but first I want to get a copy of this thing right here. All right, and this is your SI schedule. Like so. Did I have it in video mode? No, photo mode. Fantastic. Okay, so I sent everybody an email last night. And if you did not get that email, then there is a big problem because I should be able to communicate with you with email. That's a requirement of the class. And my email said that you are having a supplemental instruction session today before class. And so I know some of you went, and well, you're going to really like that. All right, so here is Janice's contact information and the room number, and I'm going to put that into Blackboard. And I actually brought Blackboard up, and I was going to show off that I have it here under the supplemental instruction button. And let me turn some of these lights down. Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. So I clicked on that button, and I noticed that I didn't upload it into a Blackboard yet. That's a different SI leader. So look at that information until I correct this information here. But that I'll probably do that this afternoon. Okay, so that's, I think, all I wanted to show you with Blackboard. But I do have a question saying, well, how do I check my grades? And it's really important when you submit a quiz that you check in your grade book to make sure that it got entered properly, especially if you're using a mobile device. Most times a mobile device won't work. So how will you check to see if it got entered? Well, click on Tools right here. And it's going to take you to a whole bunch of other links. And it's not my career, my grades. So you're going to click on My Grades, and you're going to see a list of all the possible quizzes that you're going to get this semester and what grades you have for them. I could click on this here, but it's probably going to say, huh, because I'm an instructor. Yeah, it said, huh. Okay. So the way that I would check is just I would go into a different area right over here. And so if you want me, if you want to get together with me sometime during office hours to check your grades, all right, I have all of them as well, okay? And, oh, I guess I'm in the wrong section because all these people, well, I'm curious. I don't know if I have your correct SI information in there or not. Hold on. Let's find out for sure. 6-0, that's one from this semester. All right, so always double check. Make sure your grades are in Blackboard properly, especially if you're using a mobile device. Oh, I did. Okay, phew. All right, so there it is. Is that the same information on the board? Oh, that's even better. Good. It's directing you to the right place. Okay, so that's how you would check your grades. Go to Tools, and you're going to have this icon, My Grades, but it's going to take you to your grades. It's going to be linked up to your grades. Okay. And so pay attention to that periodically. Your lab grades, you're going to have a lab quiz every week, and your lab grades are entered manually into the computer. They're not automatically graded and loaded in like a Blackboard quiz. Those you definitely have to double check, maybe triple check, make sure that you're getting the correct grade in Blackboard. Right? Because if it's a human typing it in, it's easy to make a mistake, and then you might get gypped out of some points. And we don't want that to happen. After the last lab, there won't be an opportunity to change your lab grades. So make sure that during the semester you pay attention to that and get it corrected right away. Okay, because after the class is over, there's no way that we're going to resubmit new lab grades in. So pay attention to that. All right, and also in this Tools button, when you click on this Tools button, you're going to get another icon besides My Grades, and that's McGraw-Hill. And I paired this class up with the 12th edition of the textbook. Some people have used the access code that came with the brand new textbook that you got in the bookstore. And they tried to get to the e-version of that book, but it's taking you to the 13th edition. And so there's a problem with that. I don't know if I can get that fixed or not. All right, hopefully we can get that so that when you use your access code, it takes you to the exact edition that we're using in here, because why might that be important? Why should you be using the 12th edition? because of the study guide. The study guide is very specific. It tells you exactly what page numbers you have to know, what end of chapter questions, what online questions, what figure numbers, right? And all of those things change around a little bit when you go to a different edition. That's why I contracted out with McGraw-Hill to hold on to this textbook for at least 5 years. Yeah. Yeah? Oh, another good question. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I would like to change that question around. What's important in your subject line is the course number and the CRN, not necessarily your name. Yeah, just those two things. Okay. Because I get to see your name pop up with your email pretty easily. So I know who it is. I just don't know what section you saw all those sections that I'm teaching. Okay, and the reason why I don't change the quiz, because if I were to modify the quiz right now, that would erase everybody's grade. So it's easier for me to correct the syllabus now than that quiz. All right, so go back and just those two things, course number and CRN. Make sure that's CRN, otherwise I just get lost forever trying to find you in Blackboard. All right, any other question? I think we hit all the questions pretty well. All right, here's your sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign it today. It's your responsibility to sign the sign-in sheet. I'm going to pass it around. You're going to see your name on there, but not your student number. All right, so nobody will be able to link numbers and names up together. This is your receipt that you're in class. So if I drop you from because of you're not attending class, you could have me pull this out, and you'll say, well, why did you think I was not there? Because I signed it that day, I signed it that day, I signed it that day, right? So make sure this is your receipt. Make sure you sign it. So I'm going to pass this around. I'll pass it around at the beginning of class. As long as too many people don't sign it and then immediately leave class. I do want you to be in class. All right, so that would be faking me out if you signed it and then just left. And that wouldn't be good for you either. All right, so that's something about Blackboard. Let's look at the schedule real quick. It's over on the right-hand slide. And what is today? The fourth? Oh, we got our second lecture of chemistry today. Nice. We got three lectures on chemistry. I'm glad because I don't know if I could finish chemistry today because we want to have a lot of fun when we talk about chemistry, right? Which takes some time to do that. And also because you have three lectures, what do you think? Do you think that's not important information in this class or very important? Very important, right? So I do want you to get a good foundation to know physiology. Chemistry is fundamental to physiology. All right, so that is important. Our first exam on the 25th, that's a Tuesday. I don't even know how many weeks away it is. 1, 2, 3 weeks away yet. But it seems like it's a long way away from now, but you got to start studying right away. You should be really applying yourself. At least 13 hours of study time outside of class every week. And what else? And this is a hybrid class, which means that you have to learn things online, which means it's even more than 13 hours a week. So you should be filling out that weekly study plan, showing it to me, and let's just see if you're getting the study time in. Typically, students find the last test the easiest test, but it's really the hardest test, but they know how to study for the class by that time. The first test, most students find that to be just intolerably hard, difficult test because they haven't learned how to study for the class yet or they haven't figured out how much time they really have to spend to study. So I do want to give you a warning about that, especially if you do not have a background in chemistry. That's why chemistry is always recommended by me before this class. All right, so you need to get that study time in, not a week before the exam, not 2 weeks before the exam, at least 3, probably 4 weeks before the exam, okay? So I do want you to think about that. Okay, any questions on the schedule? No, you've all met your lab instructors, and you'll get to figure out how lab goes pretty quick. And of course, you probably have a lab quiz this week, too, on something. Depends on your lab instructor. If you're unsure what your lab quiz is all about, make sure you talk to your lab instructor because I don't have a clear sense of what every instructor does. And even if there are two different labs that have the same instructor, the class from one to another might be a little bit different, and the quizzes might be different as well. So make sure you're clear with your lab instructor. All right, that's enough yakking about stuff. Nice. All right, so I'll put all this stuff away. And you saw something just pop up on the left-hand screen. Is it left on? It is a left-hand screen. Couldn't show you this last time because the projectors weren't working. But this is, if you were going to label this thing, okay, what would you label this chart or this table or illustration? I wouldn't call this a list of atomic masses, even though atomic masses are on here. This thing really is the periodic table. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Even that third page, right?
Yeah, it only goes the last
page. I don't know what happened to everybody past R. I'll just sign at the bottom somewhere, okay, if you're not on that list, and I'll have to make sure that people past R are in there, okay? Okay, thanks for letting me know. Otherwise, I never would have known, but make sure you sign in. All right, so this periodic table is really nice because it tells you how to fill up orbitals with electrons. So the first shell has how many electrons in it? Yeah, we got one, you got two. That represents that first shell. What about the second shell? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, right? So you don't really have to memorize this stuff. This periodic table tells you. We're reviewing things from last lecture. All right, but you also have some abbreviations of chemical elements. Right? And you have to understand what these abbreviations are. They're not even contractions, right? They're just symbols for various elements. And Cl, does anybody know what Cl stands for? Yeah, that's an easy one. That's chlorine. Okay, that is nice. But what about Na? That's not so obvious. Unless you speak Greek, then it is obvious. It's natrium, which in our language is sodium. And what about K? Potassium. Ooh, it's not P? What is P? Phosphorus. Yeah, so there's a table in your lecture notes. I don't think that table is in your textbook, but make sure you look at your PowerPoint lectures and find out where that table is. And you have to memorize the first two columns in that table. The third column you don't have to memorize, but it has some interesting information. It just tells you the percentage of that compound in your body compared to everything else in your body. All right, so not all of these, but most of these. Now, why are we interested in knowing something about orbitals and electrons of these elements right here? Because what do those electrons do for us? It determines the kind of chemical bonds that can be formed between elements, right? And we're chemical reactions, so we want to know something about those chemical bonds and how they're broken and how they're made. And when a chemical bond is broken and made, then you have a chemical reaction. And that's what drives our bodies all the time, chemical reactions. So we are interested in knowing something about those electrons. What kind of charge does an electron have? Negative. Is there anything that has a positive in there, or are we all negative? Protons are positive. Yeah, okay, so those things can balance out. That's a very stable condition when they balance out completely. An electron has exactly the opposite charge as a proton, even though their size is completely different, but the charge is exactly the same. And so, do electrons attract each other, or do protons attract each other? Neither. Oh, let's see, how should I think about that? Opposite charges attract, exactly right. Okay, and that provides for that nice balance condition when there's no electrical charge, right? All right, so make sure you can use this periodic table. You know the symbols, and then this table also tells you how many protons are inside the nucleus. Does anybody know what that's called? How many protons are inside the nucleus? The atomic number. And will you ever find an element in this periodic table that has the same atomic number? No, because when you change the atomic number, you change what element it is, right? That's really the definition of what an element is. So hydrogen right here has got one proton, helium over here has got two, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really easy. It's trivial to really appreciate this periodic table at that level. So we're not going to talk about this bold line right here. Okay. So there's a lot of other really good things to know. Any questions on the periodic table so far? You guys are good with that. Okay. You'll have a copy for the test, but you also have a copy in Blackboard that you can download for yourself if it's not in your book somewhere. All right, so chapter 2, atoms. What should I remember about review here? Oh, there's that table of this element names and what their chemical symbol is. All right. We talked about bonds. That's something that I want to review. What is the strongest bond, at least in this class? Maybe not in all chemistry all over the universe, but in this class, the strongest is going to be covalent. Give me in a nutshell, what is a covalent bond? What's happening?
Sharing.
Okay, electrons are being shared. It's always going to be electrons, right? And they're being shared. Perfect. What's the next strongest bond? Ionic. What's happening there? Transfer. Oh, I like that in one word. When an electron gets transferred from one element to another, so one element gets an extra negative charge, which means then where it came from, that element gets a positive charge. Right? So when something gains a positive charge, that means something else has to gain a negative charge. Right? So they have to go hand in hand. All right, what's the next strongest bond? Hydrogen bond. Okay, and that is a lot weaker. And that is due to a certain property of water. What was that property of water that produced that hydrogen bond? Okay. Surface tension is a result of that property of water. Okay. And I do want to say it out loud again. It's because water is polar. One, if you look at the water molecule altogether from far away, it's neutral. It has no electrical charge. But if you get really close to it and look at one end, it's going to have a different polarity, a different electrical charge than the other end. And that's what makes water molecules stick together. That's what produces hydrogen bonds. Something else produces polar bonds, right? And it's a covalent bond. A covalent bond. Yeah, let's look here. So right here we have two hydrogens. This is a nonpolar covalent bond. But some atoms, when they covalently bind with hydrogen, produces a polar covalent bond. And you're familiar with one because we just got done talking about it. And that is the oxygen atom produces a polar covalent bond. But there are some others. What are some others? And man, that should just be ringing in your head right now. Phosphorus, nitrogen, and sulfur. Sulfur is not on your list. Make sure you pencil that in. Okay. All right. These produce polar covalent bonds, which means then that these polar compounds like to dissolve in water. Nonpolar compounds don't want to have anything to do with water. They just are not interested. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much it from last time. We talked about acids and bases, so probably you should know what is an acid. What the heck is an acid? I'm going to try this. It's really screwy on my screen. What about yours? Yeah, it's really screwy up there too. Okay, sorry about that. At least we have this. We have this good one over here. So what the heck is an acid? It has something to do with hydrogen ions. Right? And if you have a hydrogen ion, that's just a proton, just a plain old proton. So what does it have to do with a proton or hydrogen ions? It's any kind of compound that releases hydrogen ions to water solutions. That's what an acid is. And so as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, then the solution becomes more acidic. That hydrogen ion is very reactive. It just affects chemical reactions in a drastic way. So the pH of our bodies has to be carefully regulated because all the biochemistry is going to be altered one way or the other when we change the hydrogen ion concentration or the acidity. All right, so that's an acid. It donates protons or hydrogen ions to solution. What is a base? It's a proton acceptor. And another way to think of it is that it donates something to a water solution, but it's not just a proton, but it's a hydroxyl group, an OH group, right? And when you combine a hydrogen ion and a hydroxyl group, what do you get? You just get water, right? You just get water. All right, so when you have an equal number of hydrogen ions and hydroxyl ions, right, you have pH of 7, right? And that's 10 to the minus 7th molar for both. So when they're in equal concentrations, hydrogen ion, hydroxide ion, then you have a neutral pH. So pH 7 is neutral. All right, so here's the screwy thing. And you're going to become pretty much familiar with this because you get to calculate pH. If I give you the molar concentration of hydrogen ion, all right, you'll be able to calculate pH with Right, this equation right here, so you got to have a calculator, a basic scientific non-graphing calculator with that log button. Not an ln button, but for sure you need that log button. See right here, that's log to the base 10. Okay, what was I asking? If the hydrogen ion concentration increases, is that solution becoming more acidic or basic as the hydrogen ion concentration increases? It becomes more acidic, right? So acidity and hydrogen ion concentration are directly related to each other. You increase one, you automatically increase the other. Now here's this funny kind of concept. The pH, right, is not directly related to hydrogen ion concentration. It's very important, but it is inversely related to it. So as a solution becomes more acidic, what happens to the pH number? Because of that inverse relationship, it goes down. All right, so don't get tricked with that. You're going to be working some questions, I'm sure. All right, then you'll become familiar with that. So the smaller that pH number, the more acidic it is. And we drew a couple beakers on the board last time. All right, so we said that our physiology or our biochemistry, and biochemistry really is the fundamental of our physiology, is controlled or drastically altered when the pH changes of some kind of solution. So there are chemical compounds, thank goodness, right, that we call buffers. And we have a lot of buffers in our body. You can use other kind of buffers than a chemistry lab. And the job of a buffer is to keep the pH of a solution of chemicals the same. Even if you dump in hydrogen ions, even if you dump in acid, or you dump in a base, the pH is not going to change. So that's the amazing thing about a buffer. So let's say we have a buffer that works at a pH of 2, and we add a base to that. What's going to be the acidity? What's going to be the pH of that solution if there's a buffer at pH 2? It's going to stay 2. A buffer doesn't change it to make it go to 7. It just keeps it at whatever it is. Different buffers will pick a different pH value. All right? So a buffer doesn't force something to neutrality. It just maintains whatever the pH is. And that's good because our bodies would not work very well at pH 7. Our bodies work really well at pH 7.35. Doesn't seem like much difference, but it's a huge difference. If we change the pH of our bodies from 7.35 or 7.4 to 7.00 immediately, that probably would be fatal. So it's a small change, but it produces drastic effects in our body. Okay. That's how important buffers are. Here is an important buffer, right? And we're talking about a water solution because what do you see right here? H2O, right? And then here is a compound that our body produces. This is carbon dioxide. It can combine with water to produce an acid, carbonic acid. And then carbonic acid breaks down into hydrogen ions and this bicarbonate anion. This is a very important buffer, mostly because of the right-hand side of this equation right here. Okay, here is an important chemical property. What can you tell me about the elements that are over here, these chemical reactants, compared to these over here and these over here? They can interconvert, but is it a one-way street or is it a two-way street? Can this go backwards and forwards? It's a two-way street because I see two arrows, right? It can go one way or the other. And that's going to be controlled by the concentration of these compounds right here. So if we're over here, which we are, and we add acid or hydrogen ions to the solution, it's going to combine with bicarbonate, right? So it's going to eat up these hydrogen ions, and it's going to produce this compound, and then it's going to produce water and carbon dioxide. And therefore, it reduces the amount of hydrogen ion that we added to that solution, which means that it maintains that pH for us. Because when we add this thing to water, right, it ends up as what? More water and carbon dioxide. So this is a buffer. This is the bicarbonate buffer system. All right. And if we were to add carbon dioxide to this water right here, what would happen? It would go back over in this direction. So that's called Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action. If we add compounds over here, it's going to force the reaction to the left. If we add compounds, these reactants over here on the left, it's going to force the reaction to go to the right. Conversely, if we remove bicarbonate ions, then the reaction is going to be forced to the right to replace those that are lost. And these chemical compounds can go back and forth, just to maintain the proper concentrations of these things. Law of mass action, or Le Chatelier's principle. That's why when we add acid to a solution, it forces the reaction to the left, producing water and carbon dioxide, and getting rid of these hydrogen ions. What's another name for a hydrogen ion? What is another name for this thing right here? You could look at your periodic table. Yeah, it's just a proton. Here's a proton without any electron, and people talk about hydrogen ions or protons in the same sentence. Probably they like to say proton because it's faster than hydrogen ion, right? It's just one word as opposed to two. Okay, blood pH. Normally 7.35, might go up to 7.45. Buffers in our body maintain that pH. Buffers in our body don't force the pH of our body to go to 7, right? It just maintains the pH, the proper pH overall, at least in the blood. You have some weird areas in your body where the pH might be 2. And what kind of solution is that? Is a pH 2 acidic or basic? Acidic. It's very acidic, but remember the pH number goes down. That's normal. That's the pH that we have in our stomach. Right? And that's a very rough environment, but that's what our bodies need to break certain kinds of chemical bonds, like in proteins. Right? It needs that environment to do that. In the small intestine, it goes the other way. All right, so let's go to the next topic. Unless you've got a question. Anybody got a question on pH? Probably you do. You've got to start messing around with that pH equation in your calculator. All right? Then you have to go from pH to hydrogen ion concentration, or hydrogen ion concentration to pH. Make sure you can go backwards and forwards. And everybody's calculator is a little bit different in the steps and how you enter numbers. So make sure you practice with your calculator that you're going to bring to class on that exam day. Yeah?
On a few slides prior,
yeah?
After the law equation, there was a minus
sign. Right here?
Yeah.
No. That does, and it's not, it's minus nothing, so you can erase that. Okay. However, if we do a little algebra, and this is how I think whoever made this slide up got a little confused. What is this slide right here? We got pH is equal to the log, and that's going to be the base 10. And then if you just see that log button, it's going to be base 10, right, of 1 over the hydrogen ion concentration. All right, so that's in the denominator, so that means it has an inverse relationship to pH. Okay. And what do these brackets mean? Like that. That means concentration, right? So we don't have to write out concentrations. A nice mathematical nomenclature. This is, and if you practice some algebra, this is exactly the same thing as minus the log of the hydrogen ion concentration. So here, hydrogen ion concentration is no longer in the denominator, but if we put a minus sign here, that's what shows us that inverse relationship in algebra. So I think somebody kind of rearranged that, and that minus sign ended up after the equation right here, which doesn't mean anything. Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. Never noticed that. I guess or maybe they were making that dividing line and forgot to put it in this one spot, is probably what I think. Because a minus sign really would be up here somewhere. Okay. All right, so neutral. What's the pH of a neutral solution once again? 7. That's right. Are you at pH 7? You are not. If you were, that would be really dangerous. Okay, especially if it happened very quickly. Maybe over a long period of time, you could compensate and adjust. All right, organic molecules. We're going to be interested in organic molecules, so we need a nice definition of what an organic molecule is. It's a molecule that has a carbon atom. That's important, but it's got to have something else. It's got to have hydrogen, and it's got to be covalently bonded to that carbon. So if there's a covalent bond, what's happening to those electrons? They're being shared. Yeah, covalent shared is the key term. So the hydrogen atom and the carbon atom will be sharing one pair of electrons. That is just a single bond. If they're sharing two, then that's a double bond, but hydrogen doesn't like to do that kind of stuff. Okay, and that happens because carbon has, look at your periodic table, fill up those shells, 4 electrons in the outer shell, and how many electrons should be in that outer shell for carbon to be at a low energy state? There should be four. I mean, there should be eight, sorry. And it's got four, which means that it's looking for four electrons, which means that it can bind it can make four bonds. Where is that on this slide? I thought this was on the slide. Carbon has... Nope. Okay. So carbon can bind four, can form four covalent bonds because it's looking for four electrons. Okay. And then that outer shell is all filled up. All right. So he said organic compounds got to have carbon, it has to have hydrogen, and they have to be bound together with one covalent bond. Here's a molecule, right? And it's got carbon and it's got hydrogen. It's looking good to be what kind of compound? Organic compound. And here's that bond. This line right here signifies the sharing of two electrons. It's one covalent bond. And how many did we say carbon needs? It needs four, right? It needs to share four. So one, two, three, four. Yeah, so this carbon right here is really happy. All right, this is an organic compound. Because of it satisfies that definition, we call this hexane. It's an organic compound, but it's not an important biological compound. It does not belong in our bodies. Our body doesn't produce it. As a matter of fact, it's pretty toxic. It's carcinogenic. Right? Nonetheless, it's organic. Right? But many molecules in our body have this carbon backbone, right? And that carbon backbone can form a ring. It can bend back on itself and form a ring. But furthermore, this hydrogen, or this one, or any of these hydrogens, can be moved away and another element can be placed, or can replace that hydrogen ion. We call those functional groups. So, for instance, if we put a phosphorus here instead of a hydrogen, we're changing the shape or the structure of this molecule, then what do we change? Subfunction. We haven't talked about that yet, but we're going to, right? Okay, so here's an organic compound, but it's not important as a biological molecule. But biological molecules sort of look like this, right? But they're modified a little bit. All right, so we said that it can bend back in on itself and form a ring, and here it is. And that's the exact same molecule of this one, except it's in a cyclic form, cyclic hexane. Is cyclic hexane an organic compound? Yeah, because it has carbon covalently bound to hydrogen. But again, not a biological compound. Shouldn't have this in your body. We don't draw it out like this because it's too complicated. Cyclohexane looks like that. Each one of these solid lines right here is a single bond. Right? And we don't even have to draw in the other hydrogens, the other two hydrogens at this location. This is just a nice abbreviated sign of what cyclohexane is. All right? Furthermore, sometimes we might find double bonds between carbons, sharing four electrons instead of two, in which case we get benzene. And here I can see how many chemical bonds between this carbon and this carbon. How many lines you see? Two. Yeah. So that's a double bond, in which case then this carbon gets rid of a hydrogen and that one gets rid of a hydrogen. Right? And so that's called benzene. Is benzene an organic compound? Indeed, but not a biological compound. If it's a biological compound, then we want to substitute other kinds of chemicals or atoms in these positions where we see this hydrogen. We call those functional groups. Functional groups will be added to this carbon backbone, and then the nature of that molecule is going to change. It might be a lipid, might be a sugar molecule, depending on the nature of functional groups. So here is a list of functional groups. You got to know their name and what they look like. Right, because this is sort of just the anatomy of a molecule, and if you want to understand the function of a molecule, what should you know first? Anatomy of a molecule. Okay. So this carbon has lost two hydrogens, but it still has two covalent bonds, and oxygen is ready to do that. And you're aware of that because when you have water, how many covalent bonds are there in water? There are two. And here you see two, but just in a little bit different arrangement, right? Carbon is able to do that. This group right here is a carbonyl group. A carbonyl group could be a ketone or could be an aldehyde. If this double bond is out toward the end of a molecule, that's going to be an aldehyde. Right? If it's in the middle of a molecule, that's a ketone. You're familiar with some ketones. You use one to take fingernail polish off your fingernails. When was the last time you did that? Maybe you never have. Okay. Otherwise known as fingernail polish. But I'm sure there's one person in this room that has. Who's used fingernail polish? Remover. Okay. And You know that it has a certain smell to it. It's very volatile. Okay, that's acetone, as a matter of fact. And under certain conditions, maybe pathological conditions, our body produces acetone. Okay, sometimes, and it can force somebody into an acidotic condition called ketone acidosis. And that's a really important condition to be able to diagnose right away, especially for infants and young people. Okay. So that's a carbonyl group. I want you to see that as a carbonyl group. If we have an OH, that's not carbonyl, that's a hydroxyl group, right? You're familiar with that thing. And that's different than carbonyl. It has different functions in our body. Let's go back to this slide. Here we have that carbon backbone. And remember that a carbon-hydrogen bond is nonpolar. All right, so all of these bonds are nonpolar. Does hexane like to dissolve in water if it has all of these nonpolar bonds? What's the nature of water, polar or nonpolar? It's polar. Hexane does not like to dissolve in water because there's no polarity to it. But when we start to put substitutions, different functional groups on this carbon backbone, like this oxygen, remember, what kind of covalent bond does oxygen make? Polar or nonpolar? Yeah, what's that list? Oxygen. What else? Nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur was not on your list. So here we have a part of this molecule now becoming polar, so this part of the molecule will dissolve in water, and the rest of it won't. So just kind of remember that. If all of these carbons have hydroxyl groups on them, then it will really like to dissolve in water, okay, even though it has this nonpolar background. The functional group changes how it works. Here's a sulfhydryl group. Okay, that sulfhydryl group changes this molecule from being nonpolar to being polar, right? Because that was one of the functional groups we talked about. Here is an amino group, which does what? Makes this compound more polar, allows it to dissolve in water. That's one thing that we should be aware of. If we have this carbon at the end, right, and a double bond to an oxygen, single bond to a hydroxyl group, now this thing right here becomes a carboxyl group. And what you're going to recognize with this is that it becomes an acid. Right, so when a hydrocarbon backbone has that carboxyl group at the end, it becomes... What did I just say? You should probably say it out loud. It becomes an acid, right? And acids do dissolve in water. Because when we put this in water, this hydrogen, right, we say it's an acid. Oh, what does an acid do? It donates hydrogen ions or protons to solution. So when we put this thing in water, this hydrogen ion dissociates from oxygen and it's donated to water. So that's a perfect example of what an acid is. So this is an acidic group, this carboxyl group. And then here is our last one. Here's a phosphate group. So when we say phosphate group, it's not just a phosphorus atom. Remember, this is not potassium, this is phosphorus, right? It's PO4, right? 1, 2, 3, 4 oxygens and a couple hydrogens over here. Sometimes these hydrogens can come off as well. And it leaves a negative charge here and a negative charge here. These are all polar bonds. So that means that this molecule has a lot of polarity to it. At least this end does, but this other end over here does not. Right? So this end allows this compound to dissolve in water in certain kinds of ways. All right, so carboxyl produces these organic acids, hydroxyl alcohols, or sugars. Sometimes it's hard to tell if it's an alcohol or a sugar. But in any case, what's it going to have? A hydroxyl group on it. So I do want you to recognize these hydroxyl groups. You might have a couple of these on the test, and you'll have to tell me what the functional group is. Right? By name, not necessarily by function. Maybe by function. Okay. So now we're going to look at some important biological molecules. And most biological molecules are organic. Not in every particular case, but in most cases. What is an organic compound once again? An organic compound has carbon and hydrogen, okay? We just looked at carbon dioxide, CO2. Our body produces that. Very important biological compound, but is that an organic compound? Ooh, tricky. It's not, right? But it's still important biochemically, biologically. All right, so it's not a one-to-one correspondence. But here, Let's look at this. Here is an organic compound because they have carbon and hydrogen. In this particular case, it is also an important biological compound. When we see this carbon backbone loaded up with all of these hydroxyl groups and this aldehyde group right here, that is going to be a sugar molecule. You'll recognize that to be a sugar. And this particular one is glucose. I only see one right here. Glucose is what we call a monosaccharide, a simple sugar, just a monosaccharide. All right, galactose has this look to it. It just means that there's some hydroxyl groups on opposite sides of the backbone. You don't have to memorize that, but you should recognize that as a sugar group. Okay, and then we have one down over here. It's got six carbons, just like galactose and glucose. I see a lot of hydroxyl groups, but now this double bond to an oxygen has moved from the terminal carbon to an interior part of the molecule. So that molecule, it's a sugar, but it has a different function inside your body because the shape has changed. Even though all these molecules have the exact same formula, right, they're just put together in a different way, so they have a different function. Fructose is a monosaccharide. What about galactose? It is also a monosaccharide. All right, so all of these are monosaccharides. Okay, what are disaccharides? Di means two. Two monosaccharides put together. They're joined covalently together, and we're familiar with a lot of these. Sucrose, table sugar, is a glucose and a fructose molecule put together. We're going to see how to build that in just a second. Lactose, right, is glucose and a galactose. Both of these are monosaccharides. When they're joined together, they produce what kind of molecule? A disaccharide, right, a disaccharide. Maltose is just two glucoses put together. So let's see how these things eventually are put together. A polysaccharide is built up of many monosaccharides, but not just two joined together. It's going to be many. And as a matter of fact, it could be thousands of sugar molecules joined together. And when that happens, you can get two different kinds of compounds, something that we call starch or something that we call glycogen. A polymer is a big molecule with repeating units over and over and over and over and over again. Okay? All right, so the building block for both starch and glycogen is glucose and nothing else. There's no fructose in there, no galactose, just glucose. All right, where have you seen starch before? Where have you seen starch? Probably you guys have know something about starch. Have you run into starch ever? Heard of starch? Yes, you have. Starch is that polymer that we find in plants. So it's the plant storage form of glucose. And give me an example. Potatoes, that's right. So when somebody eats a potato, what are they really eating? It's starch, but the building block is glucose, which means it's a sugar. That's right. When you eat a potato, it's almost like eating a sugar cube. And what kind of person has trouble regulating their blood glucose levels? Diabetics, right? So should diabetics be concerned about starch that's in their diet, like potato? Yeah, absolutely, because it's like eating what? A sugar cube. Okay. Other kinds of starches come from wheat. So bread is a starch, pasta is a starch, all those are starches. Diabetics have to be really concerned with that. All right. So starch comes from plants. Glycogen is what we find in animals. We build glycogen from what molecule? We build glycogen from, it says right here, glucose. Many of them put together a little bit different branching pattern to it, so it's not really starch, but it's basically the equivalent to starch in animals. We store that in muscles. We store that in liver, a lot in the liver. So when our blood glucose starts to decrease, guess what your body can do? Because it needs to maintain homeostasis, right? It needs to have blood glucose within a normal range, and if it gets below that range, that's pathology. How does your body maintain blood glucose when you're in a fasted state? You no longer have glucose in your digestive tract to go into your blood. Glucose does go into your blood, but from where? From this glycogen molecule that's in your liver. So the liver gets a signal, and it starts to break down glycogen into glucose that goes in your blood that maintains blood glucose homeostasis. Right? All right, so those are important carbohydrates. But starch and glycogen would be examples of polysaccharides. Okay. Well, what is this little thing right here that you see? Kind of looks like a stop sign maybe a little bit. That's a sugar molecule. I really want you to see that as a sugar. And indeed, it happens, just so happens to be one that we just talked about. That's a glucose. Right? So we can join these two glucose molecules together to form this disaccharide. This one's made out of glucose, so we call that maltose. This is what we call a dehydration or condensation reaction. You could say dehydration synthesis, because your body is making a disaccharide from two monosaccharides. And we're familiar with these sugar molecules. They have a lot of hydroxyl groups on them. And what happens when these things are put together, an OH from one is joined with an H from another, which produces H, how many? Two, and an oxygen, what's H2O? Water. That's why we call that a dehydration synthesis reaction. These two molecules are joined together, water is removed, and now you have that disaccharide. That can also be called a condensation reaction. When water comes out of the air and precipitates on a glass, that's called condensation as well. Kind of the same kind of term, right? Okay. All right, so here we have glucose and fructose. And we can make a disaccharide out of that. We do all the time. Right? And what kind of reaction would be used to make sucrose? It would be a dehydration synthesis reaction. So I have an OH here and an H over here, which goes to form water, and now we have that nice disaccharide. Same kind of reaction. Right? And you're going to become really familiar with that in just a little bit. Okay, so what do you know about water? Most abundant molecule in our body, right? It's the fluid that our bodies are dissolved in. All of our biochemistry, most of our biochemistry takes place in water. So water is pretty amazing, because not only is it the solvent that our body is dissolved in, but it also participates in many chemical reactions in your body. Not just the solvent, but it's a participant of the biochemistry inside your body. So it's really kind of a magical molecule from that standpoint too. All right. So let's look over here. We have maltose. What is maltose? A polysaccharide, monosaccharide, or disaccharide? Nice disaccharide, right? I see these two glucoses put together. Well, there might be a time we just talked about where we need to have glucose in our blood. So we might want to break these things down into what? Two glucoses. What do we need? We need the reverse of the dehydration synthesis reaction. Just purely the reverse. That reverse is what we call hydrolysis. And that's because in order to go in the reverse direction, what do you need to make it go? You need water. You need to break water apart as well. And that's called a hydrolysis reaction. We can break big polymers down into simple building blocks by hydrolysis reaction. Same thing for sucrose. It can be broken down into glucose and fructose with what kind of reaction? Hydrolysis reaction, right? And that's going to use up some water in our body. So our bodies produce water, consume water in various kinds of chemical reactions. That's how we would digest disaccharides into monosaccharides, but that's also how starch can be converted into single glucose molecules as well. So what's the name of the reaction that your body would use to make glucose from glycogen? How would you break a big sugar down? By hydrolysis reaction, okay. All right, so that's sugar. Oh, I do want to say one last thing about sugar, probably back up over on this slide right here, okay. I see a carbon right here and here and here and here. So at this location on the carbon backbone, what else do you have besides carbon? What else do you have? What other elements do you have bound covalently to this carbon? I see a hydrogen, yeah, that's one. What else? Oxygen, right here, and another hydrogen. So how many hydrogens at this location? Two, so H2, and what else? Oxygen, right? So here at every location in the sugar molecule, you also have a water molecule, right, H2O. Not bound together exactly as water, but nonetheless, it's still a water molecule, and that's how carbohydrates got its name, okay? Because it's a carbon backbone, but it is what? Hydrated at every location. Carbon hydrate is another name for carbohydrate, which is another kind of magical property of water. So the general form for a sugar is carbon, H2O. And this N represents, well, it could be any integer number. Like for glucose, it would be what? 6. for five carbon sugar, then you'd have a five here and a five here and a five here. But a carbohydrate is what? A carbon hydrate or carbohydrate. Okay. And that's how it got its name. All right, so now we've got to flip to another kind of organic compound, but important biological compound. I need a drink, but I'll be right back. Oh, I don't see lipids on the other screen. That's really strange. What is that thing there? Okay, lipids. Let's take a look at some lipids. They're insoluble in water because water is polar, which means lipids are nonpolar, different kinds of properties. So if they're nonpolar, don't like to dissolve in water, we say they are hydrophobic. Right, so we can use nonpolar and hydrophobic to mean the exact same thing. Okay, they consist primarily of these hydrocarbon chains and rings that we were looking at. So let's look at something right here. Here is a long hydrocarbon chain, right? Just carbon, 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 carbon. This can go on for 10 or 20 carbon atoms, and on either side you just have hydrogen atoms, which means that this thing is nonpolar, does not like to dissolve in water. But look at the end. What happens on the end right here? What kind of group is this? You haven't studied it yet, unless you, maybe you have photographic memory or something. This is what? A carboxyl group, which makes this whole molecule an acid, because when we put it in water, this hydrogen ion jumps off and makes the solution more acidic, right? Okay, so this right here is what we call fat. This is the fat part of it, but it's also an acid, so we call this a fatty acid. Probably some of you have heard of fatty acids before, right? And I just don't see one, I actually see three of them, right? I see three fatty acids. These carbon chains can be different. They all don't have to be exactly the same, but we could have three different kinds of fatty acids. And your body can combine these with something that kind of looks like an alcohol, but it kind of looks like a sugar. How many carbons do you see on this alcohol sugar molecule? I see three. Okay. This, and you have to know the name of this one, this is glycerol, not toxic. Our body can produce it, and it also uses it because it's an important building block. What can we build with glycerol? We can join, right, a fatty acid to this carbon. We can join another fatty acid to the second carbon. We can join a third fatty acid to the third carbon, right? And that becomes a glyceride when we do that. And since there's three of them, we would call that what kind of glyceride? A triglyceride. Right? Maybe you've had triglycerides measured in your blood sometime in your life, right? So that's a very commonly occurring triglyceride. That's how fatty acids can be stored in our body, as a triglyceride. So how would you make a triglyceride from three fatty acids and glycerol? You already know that reaction. That's a dehydration synthesis reaction, or a condensation reaction. So here is that water, here's the water, here's the water. When these things are joined together, you get three waters, and now the fatty acids are bound covalently to that glycerol molecule, making a triglyceride. When your body needs a fatty acid, it can go to a triglyceride and break it down with what kind of reaction? Hydrolysis reaction, right? But in order to break it down, what else has to be in that chemical reaction? Three waters, right? That's why we call it hydrolysis reaction. All right, so this arrow right here actually should be a double-ended arrow. But those two different arrows would have two different names going in this direction. Dehydration synthesis going in the reverse direction would be hydrolysis reaction. And again, that solvent water participates in that biochemistry. So here are some examples of fatty acids. A long hydrocarbon chain. I think this one here has 14 carbons in it, and there are no functional groups at any of these locations, so these are all nonpolar. So this molecule doesn't necessarily like to dissolve in water, but you see something has been substituted on the terminal carbon right here. What kind of group is this? This CO2H. We call that carboxyl, and its nature is that it allows this proton to jump off into water. It donates a proton to solution, so it is an acid. So here is a fatty acid. This particular one is palmitic acid. You don't have to know the name, but I do want you to recognize this as being a certain kind of fatty acid. Between every carbon, I only see, well, how many bonds do I see between these two carbons right here? I see one. And what about here? And what about here? And here, and here, and here, and here, and here. Everywhere is just one covalent bond, right? Never a covalent bond. So this is what we call a saturated fatty acid, because at every carbon position, there are hydrogen. There are two hydrogen atoms. As opposed to the fatty acid that's underneath it, we can see in a couple locations, not one covalent bond, but how many? And right here, I see two. I see two lines. This is a double bond, and when that happens, there's no electron available to bind another hydrogen atom right here. This molecule is not completely saturated with hydrogen atoms, so we call that an unsaturated fatty acid, like that. Okay? And so the structure of this fatty acid has changed. Let's pretend it has the same number of carbon atoms. In this case, it doesn't. But you can see this one is unsaturated, this one is saturated. The structure has changed, which means what? The function has changed, right? And sometimes these things interconvert, and when they interconvert, that changes some marvelous different biochemistry inside your body, because the structure of this molecule has changed. All right, but that is a fatty acid, which belongs to what kind of compound group that we've talked about so far? We only talked about carbohydrates or lipids. So is that a carbohydrate or a lipid? That's a lipid, right? Because of all that nonpolar part of the molecule. All right, here is one. They got to be really familiar with this one. I see 1, 2, 3 carbons, and I see some oxygens on this 3-carbon molecule. You're familiar with the name of this 3-carbon molecule already. It is, remember what that was a couple slides ago? Glycerol, right? Glycerol has 3 carbons in it. And the first and second carbon, all right, already have been bound to some fatty acids. All right, so here are 2 fatty acids. Remember that as an acidic group. But what about this 3rd carbon over here? Does this look like a fatty acid? Ah, it's got a phosphate, it's got a nitrogen. Oh, it's got oxygens in there. Not a fatty acid whatsoever. This is, okay, a phosphate group. And all of these together, you don't have to know what all these things together are, but it's a phosphatidyl group. But what can you tell me about phosphorus? What kind of bonds does it make? Polar or nonpolar? Polar, like water. What about nitrogen? Polar or nonpolar? Polar, like water. Yeah. All right. And plus, all of these charges right here make this end of the molecule really loves to dissolve in water, right? Ions like sodium, potassium, love to dissolve in water. Okay. This end right here does not. And these are big, long hydrocarbon chains. So here is a molecule that has 2 natures to it. One end is highly nonpolar, does not like to dissolve in water. This one here, on the other hand, is completely opposite. It is highly polar because of all of these atoms and this arrangement. So this end of the molecule loves to be with water. So you might say, well, how come this molecule just rip itself apart? Well, it can't because of these chemical bonds. But what's really magical about this molecule? This might be one of my favorite molecules in the whole universe. Okay. So I want to just draw a little something on the board, okay? So you might want to draw this out. So you're going to have to read my mind a little bit, because I'm not a really good artist. Okay, so, ooh, what did I just draw right there? A bottle. In particular, you would recognize this as a salad dressing bottle that you have in your refrigerator, okay? Okay, and you know something, this stuff you would like to pour, like it's filled up to here, you'd like to pour this on your salad because it has spices and it has some oils and it has some water and things on it, right? But if you pull this out of the refrigerator, it is highly ordered. You don't want to pour it on your salad just like that, because what would happen? You would only get oil. You would get all the spices and stuff like that, right? And when you pull it out of the refrigerator, right, so that means that there's oil up over here, and there's water down over here. How could you explain that difference? Nonpolar, polar, right? 2 totally different natures, and they separate out from each other. When you pull that salad dressing bottle out of the refrigerator, did you have to do anything to get it like that? Okay, I mean, with 2 separations just like that, not mixed together. Did you have to get a machine or something living in there, taking oil, put it up there, water down there? No, it just happens automatically, right? The structure appears, magic. And when you want to use it, then you got to shake it up, right? And then you get a nice mixture. Okay, well, what are we really interested in? We're interested in this thing here. I didn't draw the nice squiggles on there. What is this thing? That's a phospholipid, right? Here is the phosphate head group. Here are those hydrocarbon tails. And remember, what part of the molecule is this here as compared to this one right there? This is polar, and this is nonpolar. So we're going to take this molecule and put it in the salad dressing bottle. And it can go anywhere it wants to, right? It can just wander around in there, take a trip here and there. But where is it always going to end up? Is it going to end up in the oil, or is it going to end up in the water? I hear some water. I hear a couple for water. Do I hear any oil? No for oil. Okay. I got to tell you exactly what's going to happen. We dump this molecule in there. The polar group is going to end up right here because that nonpolar region is going to want to stick up in the oil. Just like that. You don't have to do anything. It's just going to go right there because of the chemical properties. You don't need to do any kind of special machine in there grabbing that molecule and putting it right at that meniscus, that layer, that line between these two layers. All right, so that's one. But what happens if we put a million of those molecules in here? What will happen? Exact same thing, right? You want me to take time to draw a million? Nah. All right, so I put a whole lot. All of those molecules are going to line up right smack in the middle of the bottle, nowhere else. And that's just because of the properties. Okay. So when I look at something like that, that reminds me of something when I see that. It's upside down compared to maybe how you usually see it. But you see a phospholipid layer. Have you ever heard of a phospholipid membrane? Yeah. So this is really the beginning of a membrane. And how did we build that thing? Just by magic. It just sort of happens, right? So membranes have the ability just to build themselves, right, without any kind of special properties. All right, now if we shake this thing, shake it up, right, there's going to be a nice mixture of oil and water. These things might actually bend back on each other and form something like this. All right, because all these tails that I'm drawing are nonpolar. They like to be together, right, but they're going to be in water, and then here is the phosphate head group pointing out into the water. So now you have a membrane that formed a circle right here. That's got a special name, but in general, now that sort of looks, what do you call a membrane that's circular? Maybe some stuff on the inside. A cell. Okay, so this property of this molecule just kind of allows membranes to just develop by themselves and cells. This thing really is called a micelle. And I think that's on the next slide. Yeah, here's a micelle, right? All the phosphate groups are polar, like to be with water. Hydrophobic tails like each other, so they join together on the inside of this thing, which is called a micelle. So does this sort of look like a cell a little bit to you? Probably. Okay. Okay. All right. Other kinds of lipids. So phospholipids are magical in that sense because not only are they the building block for membranes, but just because they're nature, they just make membranes. That's what they like to do. When I see a structure like this, I see a ring, I see three rings. Here's a six position ring, here's a five, and there's two down here, and then a step, and then another two, and then sometimes there's another step right here. You just kind of see the step nature of this molecule. You're going to see this as a steroid. Anytime you see a molecule that looks like this or this or this, have generally the same shape, that's a steroid. And it's a lipid. Okay, and where do lipids, where does this cholesterol like to dissolve? Water or oil? Oil. Yeah, so we find these things sometimes in the middle of membranes within this fatty region, right? And it's also used for, it's a precursor. This right here is cholesterol, you're familiar with that. That's a precursor for making various other kinds of compounds like testosterone, estradiol. What are these things? Testosterone, estradiol. Probably everybody knows. These are, oh yeah, you're a little shy. They're sex hormones in particular, right? Okay. So, and they're built from cholesterol. So what can you tell me about cholesterol? Is it good or bad? It could be either depending on the concentration, right? So you don't want to get rid of it completely because then you can't make testosterone or estradiol and other kinds of important signaling compounds like cholesterol, right? That's another kind of steroid. Okay, so I want you to recognize this thing as being a steroid. Does not like to dissolve in water, likes to be around other kinds of lipids or oils. And if you think of the phospholipid molecule, it's this part of the molecule here, not the phosphate head group. All right, another kind of lipid. These are what we call prostaglandins. Yeah, question. No, you don't have to tell me which one it is. Yeah. Just like all those different sugars, you should see it as a sugar, but you don't have to tell me if it's galactose or lactose or glucose or other kinds of things. Just see it as a sugar, general compounds, right? Okay, but what you should know about these is that sometimes they're important signaling molecules in your body. They can control physiology in different locations within your body. Same thing with these things. These are lipids. It's a long hydrocarbon tail right here, or chain of nonpolar carbon atoms that's been bent back on itself. And then here I see that carboxyl group. And you've seen these before. Where have you seen this before? Not in the bent form, but in the straight form. Where did you see this before in the straight form? Let's go back. Probably not even too many slides. Ah, right there. What are these things? Fatty acids. So here are prostaglandins, and what are prostaglandins? Modified fatty acids. So that's pretty cool. And there are all kinds of different prostaglandins in our body that regulate all kinds of different processes, and sometimes they control inflammation, maybe even temperature. Aspirin basically inhibits the synthesis of prostaglandins from fatty acids, and that why they're an anti-inflammatory, an antipyretic, and have all those other properties. Thousands of properties, because there are many different kinds of prostaglandins that aspirin affects and reduces the concentration of. Sometimes it's a bad thing. All right, so prostaglandins are just modified fatty acids that can also be used as something you might want to consider to be a hormone. They act very much like hormones. Okay. All right, so that's for lipids. Okay, that's two of the four compounds that we're going to look at. The last compound, this is really freaky. Maybe the protein part is way out over here someplace. I'm not sure. All right, protein is another class of biological compounds. And let's see if we can, here is the building block of a protein. And you already know probably what the building block of a protein is. What is that going to be? Amino acid. Does that make sense? Okay, well, here is a carbon, right? And then here is that carboxyl group bound to it. And what is a carboxyl group? Is it acid or base? That's acid, right? So here's the acid part of amino acid. Now, where do you find that amino part? Right here, right? That was one of the things that you had to memorize. This functional group, this substitution for that hydrogen that was here, we have this NH2 group, that's an amino group, right? And then we have a hydrogen here, and sometimes we have a hydrogen up over there. So if we look at this molecule, we have what? An amino acid. And this is the general form for amino acid. All right, so here you have some hydrogens. Here you have an OH. Guess what that means? That it can participate in dehydration synthesis reactions once again. So we can put amino acids together very easily, because we know how to do that kind of chemical reaction to form a protein. So all amino acids have this general kind of form, but amino acids can be a lot different from each other, because we can change the structure by removing, in some, the simplest amino acid, which has a hydrogen here. We can put other groups in this location, right? This is just a substitution position, and when you can have a lot of variability in this position making a substitution group, we put an R. And I don't know what R stands for. I don't know. Rich. Unreliable. I don't know. It could be just a number of different things, okay? And that will then determine the properties of this amino acid. We could put some nonpolar groups on there, here and here and here, right? Or we could put some polar groups on there, like maybe another acid or a sulfhydryl group or amino groups. And so now we're changing the structure of these amino acids, which means what happens to these amino acids? Their function changes drastically. But in any case, you got what? An acid and an amino group. All of these things here are amino acids, and you have about 20 different ones, common ones inside your body. And some of those you can make. Some you cannot make. I think there's 7. I forgot exactly. Ooh, I forgot exactly how many you can't make. Okay, which means then if you can't make them but you need them, where do you find them? Where do you get them from? You get them in your diet. That's right. And I think pretty much the only place where you get all of those amino acids that you can't make in one food item is an animal protein. Okay? You can get by with plant proteins if you eat a combination of plants, but probably not just from one. And cultures know this. It's passed on from generation to generation. So if you combine things like rice and beans, that's a nice complete protein. Has all the amino acids. If you eat rice by itself, no, that's bad. Probably end up with some kind of developmental problems. Eat beans only, again, the same situation. But if you combine those two food groups together, you get all 20 of the amino acids that you need. Okay, so we want to make a protein. How do we make a protein? Well, we've got amino acids right here, right? Amino acid. And we're going to join these things together with a dehydration synthesis reaction. So I got 1, 2, 3, 4 amino acids making this chain, this polymer. So 3 waters have to come out, right? And now this thing, these are what we call peptide bonds. And this is a peptide, right? And it's just the beginning of a protein, because a protein might have hundreds of these amino acids joined together, all with that same reaction that you're aware of, right? Plus, remember that this arrow right here really is not a one-way arrow, it is a two-way arrow. So you should label this arrow. What is this arrow right here? What's happening right here? Dehydration synthesis. Put an arrow going up and label that one. How would you label that one? Hydrolysis reaction. Yeah, just like that, okay? So you should be pretty familiar with that. Less than 100 amino acids, that's a polypeptide. Greater than 100 amino acids, then we call it a protein, typically. Okay. All right, so I'm going to have you draw this in lab, probably next week, because I forgot to tell you over the weekend. So you're going to draw amino acids in lab, and then a down arrow, and then here is a protein. So I want you to be able to draw this peptide bond out. That will be an extra credit drawing. Don't have to do it. You can opt out. Won't hurt your grade one way or the other. All right, but this will help you get practiced in observing some of these chemical nomenclatures and bonds and how these molecules are put together. Okay. All right. So, proteins. Let's talk about proteins. Lots of amino acids put together. And depending on the amino acids, right, it can have all kinds of different shapes. And we want to talk about the different kinds of shapes that a protein can take. All right, so what we have right here, all right, here is an R group. So this is one amino acid. I see another amino acid here, and I see another amino acid here. So here's a tripeptide. And the primary structure of a protein is just what amino acids are put next to each other within a long line of amino acids. And remember, these R's can take different groups. They can be different groups. So this one might have a carboxyl group. This one might have an amino group. This one right here might have a nonpolar group. Right? So, and it could be any one of 20 amino acids put here. Another, any one of 20 amino acids put here. And any one of 20 amino acids put here. Right? So it can have a lot of variability. And when you change the amino acids, you're changing the structure of this protein. Of course, it's going to change the function of it. Knowing what amino acid goes in what position is like understanding and knowing how to spell a word, right, with its letters. Right? So how would you spell the word R? We are in class right now. How would you spell that word R? A-R-E, right? So what happens if we switch those letters around? Right? We say instead of A-R-E, we're going to have E-R-M. What's the meaning of that word? Is it the same as ARM? No, same letters, but it has totally different meaning. The way that these letters or amino acids are put into a chain is what we call the primary structure, right? The primary structure of a word gives the meaning of that word. So primary structure is just what amino acid comes next to the one before it. So that's the first kind. The second kind of structure is when these amino acids are put together, sometimes they like to bend back on each other. Sometimes they form a nice helix. We call that an alpha helix. Sometimes it's going to look more jagged. We call that like an accordion, a beta pleated sheet. And these have certain kinds of functions in our body. Okay. And what determines if something is going to be an alpha helix or maybe a straight segment or one that's a beta pleated sheet? What's the building block for alpha helix? What's the building block for beta pleated sheet? It is primary structure. Primary structure is the building block for secondary structure, right? And here you see some secondary structures. The thing that looks like a spring or something that looks like an accordion. Well, this is just one part of a protein. It's going to have other parts. And this structure right here is going to determine how that protein bends around completely, right? So not just this one segment here, but all of those amino acids in a protein. So here, what do I have right here? Ah, it's labeled. What do I have right here? Alpha helix. Say, I have alpha helix right here. And that helps determine the shape on how this protein all curls up and bends upon itself. Right? So if we look at the complete protein and how it's all bent upon itself, that's the tertiary structure. But that tertiary structure is dependent on what? This alpha helix being there. Alpha helix is what kind of structure? Secondary structure. So the tertiary structure depends on the secondary structure, right? So if we change the secondary structure, we change the tertiary structure of that protein. Okay. And some of these proteins can incorporate other kinds of molecules. Like, for instance, this is what we call a heme group. There's an iron molecule right in the center of it, which makes this molecule able to carry oxygen in our body. So here is a representation of something maybe like hemoglobin. Okay, and this iron can be bound right in the center of this molecule because it has the right shape, just like that. This molecule might not be able to carry this iron in this location within the molecule. How would we know? How could we do that? Well, we could change what? We could change the primary structure, which then changes the secondary structure, which then changes this tertiary structure, and there might not be room within this molecule to put this iron atom anymore. It's because it changes the shape of the molecule. Furthermore, this molecule right here has the right kind of shape to where it can bind other molecules that have this shape. Like right here, I see four of these groups together. This is what we call the quaternary structure. So a hemoglobin molecule, right, has these four irons because it's made of these four subunits of these proteins. And so you can now tell me how many oxygens are carried by every hemoglobin molecule. If it's built right, it can carry four, one in each of these locations. Right? But if we change the primary structure of these subunits right here, what does that change? If we change the primary structure, changes the secondary, changes the tertiary, changes the quaternary structure to where you might end up with hemoglobin that can't carry oxygen. And in some cases, that happens to people. Sometimes their hemoglobin can carry oxygen, and under certain circumstances, because there's a change in the primary structure, it changes the shape of this hemoglobin and it can no longer carry oxygen. That's the case with sickle cell anemia. And that's the result of changing just one amino acid in the primary structure of hemoglobin. So just a change in one amino acid changes the structure. Would you think a lot or a little? If you just change one out of 10,000, just a little bit. It changes the structure a little bit, but even a little change in structure can produce what? Huge changes in function. Okay, huge changes in function with only a small change in the structure. Okay, so you got to know the building blocks. The building block of secondary structure is what? Primary. What's the building block of tertiary structure? Secondary, right? And quaternary structure, the building block is, tertiary structure. So they're all related to each other. Here's the last thing that I want to mention. All right, so in terms of chemical bonds, how many chemical bonds are we aware of? What types of chemical bonds are we aware of? The most general. There's actually four, but I'm thinking of the most general. You got sharing, you got transfer, and you got hydrogen. This is my simple way of thinking about it, which means what? Covalent, ionic, and hydrogen bonds. Okay, those are the three simplest. Here is a fourth one. Most people maybe don't even consider this a chemical bond, but in this class I want you to consider this one, and it is the weakest kind of bond between molecules. Okay. Here is an ionic bond. Or here, let's start with this. This is a big, long protein, and you can see a lot of alpha helix here, and it's bending back on itself. What helps make this bending is that you might have an amino acid here with a carboxyl group way out over here at some other distant location. You might have an amino acid with an amino group, and these ionize, right? This amino group becomes positive. This carboxyl group becomes negative. What can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other, so here is an ionic bond, and that forms what? Kind of a weak association between these two locations within the polypeptide. It helps make that bend in there. Okay, so that's an ionic bond, not very strong. In another location, right here, I have a sulfhydryl group on one amino acid, a sulfhydryl group on another. That can actually form a nice covalent bond, getting rid of those two hydrogen atoms. And what can you tell me about a covalent bond? Is that strong or weak? That's a strong bond. So here, right, the conformation or the structure of this protein is held together or made with this strong bond. It's difficult to break that. Not so difficult with this one, right? So this provides for a lot of stability of a protein when it has these disulfide bonds. Here we have a couple functional groups on amino acids in different locations of the protein that can form a hydrogen bond. And what can you tell me about a hydrogen bond? Is it weak or strong? That's the weakest one so far. So this one you can make easily, but you can also do what? Break it easily. You can put it together, take it apart, put it together, take it apart. So if you want to rearrange a molecule, have it one shape one moment, right? Have it do something, and then have it another shape for it to do something else another moment, this is a beautiful kind of bond to have because you can zip things up and unzip things very easily with this kind of bond, right? And it's a hydrogen bond. Here is the last one. The fourth one that I have not talked about, and this is by far the weakest one, but it does provide stability within a molecule. These are called van der Waals forces. Van der Waals force is the weakest kind of bond. But, all right, so write that down maybe on this slide. So what is a van der Waals force? Okay, I just see hydrocarbon in this functional group on an amino acid over here and then way over here. All right, so hydrocarbons, are they polar or nonpolar? What about this? Do you see any oxygens? No. Any phosphates? Any nitrogens? Any sulfur groups? No. So here is, these are both nonpolar regions right on this molecule. So do these nonpolar regions want to be sticking out where water is? No, because water is polar. So they like to stick together by themselves because they have that same nature, right? Just like these guys here. That's what we call a van der Waals force. And even these, like these benzene rings right here, are nonpolar. They like to stick together and be away from water. So that association between nonpolar groups is what we call a van der Waals force. And that is weaker than a hydrogen bond. All right, so the order, you got what? Covalent, ionic, hydrogen, van der Waals force. Okay, and we see that in the tertiary structure of this molecule. And this is this an exam figure? Right here, is this an exam figure? Anybody know? Might be. I don't know. I can't remember. Okay. So what time we got? We got maybe a couple minutes left. And I think I can finish maybe one more concept. Oh, one more slide. Yeah, let's get it done. That is an exam figure. Okay. So make sure you can label what? Covalent bond, ionic bond, hydrogen bond, van der Waals force. Yeah. Okay, the exam figure, what you have to know is what's ever erased from the study guide. Okay, yeah, so if you see a missing piece in the study guide, that's something that you have to know. So you probably don't have to draw this whole thing out. I could make this extra credit maybe, draw it in lab. Maybe next time. Okay, what about the last thing? Okay, sometimes proteins are used as a building block for a more complicated molecule. Sometimes you got a protein and a sugar molecule is added to it. What about the function now of that molecule? Drastically changes because it's not even a protein anymore. It's what we call a glycoprotein because it contains sugar molecules. How would you make a glycoprotein? With a condensation or dehydration synthesis reaction, right? Because sugars like to do that, proteins like to do that. There are places in your body where they are put together. The same thing, you might have a protein and it can be joined with a lipid. That would be a lipoprotein, different than a glycoprotein, right? And then some other kinds of proteins, like we saw in a previous example, different kinds of organic compounds can be put into a protein, again, to change its function drastically. Like in hemoglobin, contains an iron. And iron in that kind of configuration absorbs a certain color of light and reflects another color. It reflects a red light. So when all the colors of the rainbow hit on hemoglobin, it absorbs everything except red. Red is reflected back. So when you look at hemoglobin, what does it look like? It looks red because it can't absorb that. Any kind of molecule that absorbs light is what we call a pigment. All right, so all of these chairs right here, you guys are good at this. I'm not so good at this. They have color to them, right? So what's in all that plastic that makes these chairs that color? A pigment. And what kind of pigment is it? What is it reflecting back to our eyes? Yellow, right? Because these are yellow chairs. Thank you. Yeah, so it's a yellow pigment. Not because it absorbs yellow, but because it absorbs everything else but yellow that gets reflected back. So a pigment is just something that absorbs light and its energy, light energy, and the color is determined by the wavelength. Light has different kinds of colors. You're aware of the rainbow, right? Those are just different energy levels. Here are some examples of proteins, right, and what they might be conjugated with. These are conjugated proteins right here. And make sure you sign the sign-in sheet for today, right? That's your receipt that you're in class. And I didn't finish up the chemistry chapter today, but that's okay. We got one more lecture.